Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and we are in the year 2017, and it has already been eventful. It is time for the first episode of The Three Horsemen for the new year, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts. Say hello to Mr. John Stevens.
What? Nothing's happened this year. It's been very quiet. I can't believe it. I am not at all freaking out about the new year, not in any way, shape, or form. But I am also, what am I? I'm a bookseller and a writer. I have my own book concern, and I work at another bookstore. And I am also a writer and a critic and a reviewer when the mood strikes me, apparently. And I'm usually found on Twitter at Erudite Ogre. Saying stuff.
And of course, in the other chair, Mr. Fred Kish.
Yes, I am. Hi, it's Fred Kish. I can be found as Fred Kish on Twitter. I have a blog at Bernal Alpha, and otherwise I just go to work and come home and fall into bed. So 2017 is pretty much 2016 all over again.
See, time, all is well.
Time is an illusion. Well, one thing I really want to say here, speaking of booksellers, we're recording this on the 22nd, and on Friday, Locust announced that Larry Smith had died. If you've gone to any major conventions, world cons, especially stuff on the East Coast, you've probably bought books from Larry. I estimated probably about a fifth of the collection that I have on my shelves right now of paperbacks I bought from him. There was probably an 11-year period where I saved almost all my book buying for ReaderCon. And once I got there, probably about half my purchases came from him, primarily of new stuff. He was, number one, incredibly knowledgeable. Number two, very well liked. And number three, always incredibly professional. And I don't think I ever made a visit to his table where one author or another wasn't coming up and signing books that he had, and he just was such a fixture of conventions. And when I went to my last Capclave up in Maryland, I asked his wife, because he had just had a crowdfunding thing for an illness he had, and I talked to his wife for a bit to see how he was doing, and I'm very, very sad that I'm never gonna see him again. I do plan on getting up to a convention or two at some point this year, and we'll definitely buy books from his wife Sally if she continues the business. I don't see why she wouldn't, but yeah. John, I'm assuming you ran into him at ReaderCon more than once.
Yeah. Yep, I did, and at WorldCon. I mean, he was one of the things he did for WorldCon is he ran the dealer's room and was sort of the head of the committee that actually selected the booksellers that were allowed to sell at WorldCon. So I had an interaction with him last year for when I was thinking of trying to sell at WorldCon. But yeah, I mean, I've bought books from him. And it was always it's the problem with being a bookseller. It's always a little hard to pay full price.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, actually the first couple of years I went to ReaderCon, I was kind of surprised. I was like, how does someone, you know, sell brand new books at full price and full are just buying a man over fist. And, you know, and part of it was, like you said, there were always authors hanging around and signing stuff. And, but also, you know, people, my impression was people often, you know, sort of save their money, like you were talking about, and specifically bought from him because he had a really good selection and he knew his stuff. He was,
yeah,
he was sort of a, he was a real expert on science fiction and fantastic books. So that made it, so that was an extra little bit of service you got essentially from him. So,
so yeah,
I mean, I hope his wife continues on with the business, but I know it's, that's hard there, you know, given what I know about overhead and, you know, how much new books cost nowadays.
Yeah.
It's hard. That's a hard way to make, I mean, book selling is a hard way to make a living nowadays, but that's just really, you've really got to have loyal customers. You have to have the stuff that people are looking for. So you have to really know what you're buying, and you have to make sure you can bring both, you know, the books, but also the knowledge to help people choose good books, introduce them to new books, and stimulate their experience as readers.
I mean, I used to think about the fact that you would see him at almost every single convention set up, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, that, that kind of a, you know, almost gypsy lifestyle of going around selling books, and yet he was constantly making recommendations and telling you, if you like this, you'll like this. And I was like, how the hell do you have time to read? He was, I'm pretty certain I saw him at a RavenCon once, which kind of surprised me that he had ventured that far south for what was effectively such a small con. Capclave didn't surprise me. He was always, he had a full setup. He took up one entire wall at that.
I'm trying to remember if he was at RavenCon the year that I went. I don't think so.
I remember the first time I went to Capclave, I went up, you know, specifically to go see Jamie Todd Rubin. And I walked into the dealer's room, and there he was. And I was so happy. I was like, yay, he actually, he does make the travel to cons when it's there. And Capclave was very much like ReaderCon in that it was focused primarily on books. It was very little media discussion. So,
right.
He had actual shelves set up and all that. So, yeah, I'm going to miss him.
And that's what made him kind of the anchor at ReaderCon. Because so many of the ReaderCon sellers are specialized.
Right.
They're either publishers or they're rare book dealers.
Right.
Or they're sort of inexpensive book dealers in terms of they buy a lot of not just secondhand books, but remainders and stuff and sell them.
Right.
So he occupied almost a unique niche at ReaderCon. Both for, not just for selling new books, but for the variety. Like no one could really match his variety anywhere.
That's the thing. His selection was the main mm-hmm. was the main draw. And you'd get there, and he'd have all the hardcovers and trade paperbacks arrayed in stacks like brickwork on that main table. And they'd be like seven or eight deep. And of course, there'd be one book that he only had one copy left of that you actually had to lean over the table all the way to actually look down into the hole to see what the book was. Yeah, it was always an adventure. Damn, I'm going to miss him. He was definitely a fixture. I was very glad to see that he you know, made mention in Locus and File 770.
Yeah, and so. I think is it SF site, I think, has a pretty full obituary too.
Oh, really? Okay. I did not read that. So, Fred, do you know, was he at any of the honor cons you went to?
No, they basically had no book selling presence, really. Oh, but I did buy online from him on occasion, so years ago. Mm. And it was definitely a name that was known all up and down the coast.
Yes, it was. So, him and what's his name? Pierre, the guy that does
filthy
the
beer. Yep. Yep.
Filthy beer.
Yep.
Two fixtures. Well, I'm going to miss him, and we send our best to Sally. The world moves on, as it always does. So, one of the things we want to do on this episode is kind of put 2016 to bed. with two in the back of the head. But there were some real bright spots when it came to science fiction and fantasy in 2016. And we wanted to talk about a few of those. And we wanted to also talk about some stuff we are looking forward to in 2017. Because there is a lot of stuff coming out. Some of it connected with releases from last year, and some of it brand spanking new. So, Fred, what do you have on your list?
Well, of course you asked me first. 2016. Well, let's see. Weirdly enough, I barely made 60 books read last year.
Oh.
And most of them were, yeah.
What?
Most of them were rereads. So the only new book I read last year, and it's on my list, is Keyes Johnson's The Dream Quest of Vallette Beau, which is like a reboot of H.P. Lovecraft's Unknown Kadath book. So I, you know, that one I enjoyed a lot as a new book. I mean, I reread a lot of stuff.
I've just started reading that.
Reread a lot of stuff. I mean, we covered, for example, C.J. Cherry, and rereading the Shawner series, you know, The Pride of Shawner, Kiff Strike Back, etc., was real fun. It has been years and years since I read that. Ellison's Deathbird stories, some of them still haunt me. Cordwainer Smith, when we covered his stuff, you know, that was an enjoyable reread. And Roger Zelazny, I reread Doorways in the Sand again for, I have no idea how many times I've read that. It's still my favorite book by him. And I also read his the first volume from Nesva of his short stories, the collected stories of Roger Zelazny, Volume 1, which is called Threshold. And that series, that collection from Nesva, I really recommend because they put a lot of notes into it. You know, so almost every story has some sort of you know, background, you know, why he wrote it, or notes on the mythology that's in there, words, references. So it's really good academic work as well as a good collection of stories. Comics. I mean, I read I got through 333 titles last year.
Holy crap!
Well, you know, so that includes like multiple. You know, if Darth Vader had five issues, I count that as five titles. So, you know. Just so you know. So, I mean, the highlights, oddly enough, mostly it was split between Star Wars, anything Star Wars, especially Darth Vader, and then the launch of the spinoff from the Darth Vader series, the Dr.
Aphra.
But, you know, I mean, I was kind of sorry to see that many of the titles I liked the most ended, because I guess they're bringing them back into the main line. So, you know, the Han Solo one ended, the Lando Calrissian one ended, Chewbacca, Princess Leia. I mean, the main Star Wars title I actually don't like as much as those Solo stories. So I'm hoping the Dr. Aphra continues that tradition of the high quality, but not the tradition of ending after a limited run.
I think they might be trying to use like the model that Mignola uses with Hellboy, where, you know, give characters their own titles as needed and then bring them back into a primary storyline, and which is a fairly smart move.
And on non-Star Wars graphic titles, I really liked a short run series called Holmes and Watson, which is a New York reimagining of Sherlock Holmes and James Watson, but totally different from either of the TV series that are on now. Injection with Warren Ellis. I'm looking forward to the next one of that. The Black Monday Murders by Jonathan Hickman and Tom Coker is a fantastic mix of finance and the occult. The Fuse, Anthony Johnson, is a space detective at a big orbital factory and colony. That is currently on a hiatus because everyone's too busy, but I'm hoping it comes back at some point. The Sheriff of Babylon by Tom King and Mitch Gerards was a mystery series set in Baghdad, let's say circa 2004 thereabouts. you know, not science fiction, mm-hmm. not genre, no superheroes, but a really good story.
That's a killer book, man. That is so
And
good.
Finally, something that we will be visiting again in the near future, I hope. Courtyard, Neonomicon, and the first couple of issues of Providence by Mr. Moore and company. So those were my graphics favorites. And then I would be remiss if I were not to mention podcasts, considering they kept me sane through much of the work year. So among my favorites, Ken and Robin talk about stuff to game designers who also discuss things like books, movies, and even cooking on occasion. You know, as soon as every episode drops on Friday, I listen to it. The main show from The Incomparable, our network now. Again, a mixture of stuff. Always good panels. Cood Street Podcast, Rambling with Gary and Jonathan. Jonathan having been a guest in the past, and hopefully Gary a guest in the future. Galactic Suburbia, which hasn't dropped a new episode this year, I think, so I hope they're coming out with one soon. The H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, Chad Pfeiffer and Chris Lackey examine the works of Lovecraft and others in a not-so-serious fashion and, you know, do a good job of it. Hypnagogue, which is something I discovered through Warren Ellis's newsletters. That's an ambient music podcast. Unfortunately, the first 44 or so episodes are missing, lost in the midst of the internet. But each episode's like over an hour long and really worth it. And then finally, another gaming podcast called The Grognard, in which each episode he covers old games, some out of print, some, you know, just been around forever. And that really got me into looking at some of my old games again and saying, I should take these off the shelves and start playing them again. Best movies last year, Star Wars Rogue One and Ghostbusters. My goodness, women in genre, what shocking. But, I really like both of those, especially Rogue One. If nothing else, for the killer robot that's in there that so echoes the favorite killer robots from some of the other Star Wars properties, including Dr. Aphra. And TV, The Expanse and Stranger Things both really piqued my interest. I didn't watch a heck of a lot of TV last year, but those two were definitely among the things I did watch. And that takes care of me.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you got?
Nothing.
I have stuff. I am sort of looking at my input last year. I was trying to think what the best was, and I realized last year I was very sort of catch as catch can. I read some books for review that I wouldn't have ordinarily read, which was nice. I didn't actually watch a lot of movies. I watched a lot of TV. And to the point where this year I actually have a goal of watching 100 movies that are new to me. So far I've seen 8. And not counting several episodes of Riff Tracks. Like, they are movies, but I've seen most of them before. I'm not really there for the movie so much as
the comedy.
You know, it being busted on. Yes, exactly. So, but anyway, so I was trying to put together a best of list, and it was a little hard to do, particularly because I read and saw some stuff that wasn't actually 2016. But anyway. For books this year, I read Jerry Canavan's book on Octavia Butler from the University of Illinois' Masters of Science Fiction series just at the end of the year. And that was really good. That was a pretty good book, but it's probably one of the best of the series. It's right up there with Karen Burnham's work and Jad Smith's stuff. And what I liked about it was he is an academic, and he certainly knows his lit crit and cultural theory, but the approach he took was much more grounded. He didn't really, you know, take reader response theory or something and try to apply it to Octavia Butler. What he did is he did a try to do a close reading of her work from his own very particular perspective, and he filled in a lot of, you know, blanks about her, details about her, from his research in her archives and such. So you got a picture of Butler herself, you got a really nice discussion of her writing, but you also saw some outline of the links between them. Like a lot of the book is talking about how Butler's particular attitudes and things that she wrote about that she was concerned about in her journals and such came out in her writing. You know, some authors go to great lengths to say, oh, my work is not political and my work doesn't, you know, talk anything about my urge to have fun. But Butler's work is so intimately tied up to her personally and to ideas she wants to get out in the world and sort of play with, that it really enriches your understanding of her work by reading this book. And that, for me, I think is the best thing that these kind of books can do, is actually stimulate your interest in the author by talking about their work and hinting at some of the things you could find to look for them. So that was definitely a winner for me from 2016. Also, another book that was sort of a rereading was, I read this sort of Bridges comic book and book, but was Zot, the Complete Black and White Collection, that collects all of Scott McCloud's Zot comics from 1987 to 1991. And I first read them when they came out, you know, in their sort of rather irregular schedule. But to sit down and read the whole thing, basically in one go, was really a different experience. And I was very pleased that it holds up as a complete product. It was very good as a serial, but it really holds together all together too. And I like that a lot. And Zod is really one of my just favorite characters, because McCloud takes a very playful approach to Zot and to his world. But there's also a lot of serious moments too. He does a nice mix of comical and serious work, which I always admired about Zot. So that you're very entertained, but you can also sit back and think a little bit. And I like when a writer can actually pull that off in their stories. So that was quite lovely. And I'd like to actually read it again soon. Then we kind of start going afield from fantastic stuff. I read, regular podcast listeners will recall that I've been reading a fair amount of Chinese hermit poetry this year, or this past year. And one of my favorite things that I read were the Mountain Poems of Stonehouse, who was a hermit monk who basically spent his life kind of living in the local monastery to hang out in the kitchen and work for his food. And he would write these relatively short poems. They're very anchored. They're very much just about little details and about life. And there's not a lot of philosophizing directly, but they're poems you can read. And again, you can sort of start thinking about their significance to you as a reader, and they become quite rewarding. So that was definitely favorite of the year too. And then I have to mention Nancy Hightower's The Acolyte, which is a collection of fantastic tree that I reviewed for Joe McDermott's Grump Troll. And I was a little trepidatious about doing, because I find it often hard to review poetry, but this was such an eloquent collection with so much to dig into and so much to think about and admire that it was actually quite easy to write about, which I thought was a good sign. And even though I had, I think, a different interpretation than other reviewers and readers did, that was, I felt another strength of it was that you could, you know, read it and get stuff out of it, more attuned to your own needs and personality. So that was really a lot of fun to read for such a portentous collection. and that really was one of the most, I think, one of the most satisfying things I read all year. So kind of an odd set of things for written material. And then, like I said, as far as, you know, viewed media goes, I didn't watch a lot of stuff. Film. I watched a lot of TV series, and only a few of those really stood out. I've actually not watched Stranger Things yet, so I will have to explore that. But I did watch the Brazilian science fiction series 3%, with weak world building, but very strong in most of the other categories in terms of plot and characterization, character interaction, and things like that. I thought they did a very good job, so I liked that quite a lot. And then nothing else really stood out hugely for me in that category. I watched a lot of other stuff. Some of it was very pleasing, but thinking about, you know, best ofs, that's really about it, I think, for my media viewing. And that's another reason I want to go back to movies this year and see if I can find more of, you know, what I'm interested in through movies.
Neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been watching I did a couple of minor rewatches, but I didn't watch hardly any TV at all. Couple British game shows and Red Dwarf. I watched Red Dwarf, which was great fun. As a friend of mine pointed out online, it was great that we just fell right back into that universe without it requiring a reboot or a prequel or anything like that. It was quite nice.
So you watched the new ones are as good as the old ones?
I would definitely say so. Yes, especially the first episode that came out, where they end up at an alternate version of Prohibition, where instead of alcohol being banned, it's science that's being banned. And it was they had their own little speakeasies, and you know the cops are busting over, you know, racks of test tubes and stuff like that. It was. It was really good. It was awesome. Really good. And a great one where Crichton wants to meet God. That was a good one too. That was, yeah, neat stuff. I'm going to start with the two books that for me were really standout. One was Nine Fox Gambit by Yoon-Ha Lee, which was just brilliant. Just exactly what I was looking for in an expansion of his work into novel form, and to have it so decompressed, but still have that, not so much an economy of language, but a precision of language that the stories have. And jumping ahead a little bit, the second book in that series, Raven Stratagem, is coming out in 2017. That's one thing I'm definitely looking forward to. And the last read that I had for 2016 was probably also my favorite, and that was Revenger by Alistair Reynolds, which I thought was a definite step up from the Blue Remembered Earth series. I really like the Blue Remembered Earth series, but I personally think he plays better when he's got a bit of a larger canvas to work with. And as much as I really got into the progression of events in Blue Remembered Earth, I really thought that Revenger, you know, hits the ground running almost immediately and keeps it up. And I really like the feel that it had. Great, great characters, great premise of a solar system that has been occupied multiple times by various races and going around hunting for the relics of those races. And I'll definitely, I know I talked about Jerusalem by Alan Moore last time, but that was probably one of the more interesting experiences of the year, was basically just getting the header on that. The fact that he wrote such an utterly challenging book while still managing, for the most part, to be entertaining. And the fact that every chapter had so many little side roads that it went down to make individual points from various points of view, addressing the state of things in middle-class England as seen by characters of assorted statuses, both economical as well as metaphysical, living and dead, etc. A few comics that were real standouts for me. I actually found myself going back and rereading all of the new version of Lucifer by Holly Black and Lee Garrett. And I really think that there's been a couple missteps in the book, but she has really stepped into that character, especially when it comes to that character's voice, and has been bringing back some of the characters from Mike Carey's run on it and has captured them really, really well. It cannot be emphasized how, once again, it comes down to precision. Lucifer had a specific set of morals and attitudes and character traits, and I think she's managed to pull it off almost seamlessly from Mike Carey's work. I also want to talk about Gail Simone's Clean Room. We've talked about Gail Simone a lot on this podcast and the various properties that she's worked on, Catwoman, Red Sonja. Or I'm sorry, was it Batgirl she wrote? It was Batgirl, yes. Wasn't it?
Batgirl.
Yeah, Batgirl.
Wow, even I knew that. Red Sonja.
Yeah, my bad. Clean Room is interesting for a couple of reasons. Number one, it is a horror series it's not an anthology series. It's an ongoing story. And I can't imagine how tough it is to come up with a prolonged horror setting that manages to be as chilling as this has been in all the issues so far. And she's also really nailed down some spectacular characters who each have their own bits of baggage that they bring with them. And when it gets scary, it gets really scary. And to be able to keep that up for as long of a duration as she has with that book really stood out for me. And once again, you know, she's just so good at writing things like dialogue and really, really stage directing her characters. It's such a unique book. You know, I can see how a drama or a crime series can manage to keep up the pace, but I think it must be a little tougher when it comes to things like horror, and it's been really good. It's also hands down one of my favorite regular horror comics, supernatural comics out of everything that's come out. I talked about Marjorie Luz's Monstrous a couple times when it comes to individual issues. That book really delivered. Enough cannot be said just about A, its embrace of the fantastic, and B, the sheer lushness of the art and the way that it's a lot of the storytelling hinges on the art being as good as it is. It's unique in that regard. There's been a lot of books that have, you know, spectacular art. Lady Mechanica is one that leaps out to mind, but is just so, so utterly beautiful and such great middle tones. It's never really gaudy or anything. It's usually very subdued. Sana Takeda is the artist on that book. Thank you. The other book that I want to mention that really hit it out of the park for me was Rick Remender and Jerome Opeña's Seven to Eternity, which managed to be a just really good science fantasy story in the vein of things like Saga and other books that have come out. But it's really got such meticulous artwork, and it's got a very grim outlook as well. And it's hands down my favorite book that Remender has done outside of the big two universes. But it's been really good, and I don't know exactly where he's going with it yet, but it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's one of those books that really isn't making the splash that I thought it would have, given how just gorgeous the art is when it comes to aliens and monsters and weird settings and all the fun trappings that you get when you do a science fiction comic. And the one other thing I want to mention, because this was probably one of the things that I thought the most about when it came to what I was reading this past year, because 2016 was when Heavy Metal was under the editorial guidance of Grant Morrison, and I was real curious where he was going to go with it. And he did two things with the book that I was very happy with. Number one, he kind of flushed out a lot of the creators that had been mainstays of the book in the last 5 to 7 years and replace them with some more under the radar creators that showed some really good talent. And there were a lot of people that were very good at, there was a lot of gorgeous stories before Grant took over, but they tended to be rather dull stories as well. That has not been the case with the new stuff. The problem for me, and it's been a gorgeous book and it's delivered and there's lots of great art galleries in every issue. And the covers have been good. The covers have kind of been throwbacks to the early 80s heavy metal, which is nice, as opposed to the constant parading of TNA, which dominated the book for
decades.
You know, under Kevin Eastman. And even though, I mean, Kevin Eastman is still involved with the book, but he's certainly given Grant a lot of liberty. The thing for me about it, though, is that as refreshing as it was to quote unquote have heavy metal back, it strikes me that there's a bit more irony in the book now than there was in the past. And I think that it's almost like he's more dedicated to the stories being subversive than outstanding. There are a lot of stories that either riff on something or not necessarily parody something, but definitely satirize other elements in science fiction and fantasy and comics that they were gorgeous to look at. And sometimes they were laugh out loud funny, but the stories always tended to get to about the 80% mark and either not stick the landing or, you know, not really deliver with the gut punch that they could have. But on the whole, it's been really good. The art's been fantastic. They brought a lot of artists back that haven't been in the pages in quite a while. And that made me very, very happy. So I'm kind of interested in where he's going to go with going into 2017 or how long he'll actually be on this particular project. It'd be nice if it was long term, but knowing the way Grant Morrison hops around and has so many unfinished projects already, I don't want to throw more on his plate. So that was 2016. And of course, we have to once again thank Jason Snell for giving us a home in 2016, which we did not have. Always good to be wanted. So, looking at that, our speaking of our old home, our dear friend John DiNardo had an excellent two-part piece at Kirkus Reviews talking about all of the books that are coming out in 2017, which, of course, we all know is right up John's alley because he loves talking about books. And it's a really good article. It's also quite exhaustive, too, because he really links things together thematically, and he breaks it down by month, and he talks about stuff that, you know, other authors have developed in the past that they're actually moving forward to in 2017. And I'm wondering if there's anything sticking out in y'all's minds regarding things that are coming up that definitely on your radar is must at least look into.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that sounds really intriguing for the year coming up. And and actually a lot of it wasn't on John's list.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I went a wandering, I did. Wandering. Let's see. So, man, there's just, I mean, I was actually trying to hone down a list for this, and it just turned out to be hard just because, like, it looks like we're going to have a pretty solid year coming up. So, pretty obvious one, which is Jeff Vandermeer's book, Born, which is coming out, I think, in the spring, and which lucky people already have galleys of.
Yeah.
And it's sort of it's a standalone of his that's loosely tied to sort of one of his worlds, and it still deals with sort of a lot of environmental issues and stuff like that, which has become kind of Jeff's hallmark now. But it sounds really promising, and I've when I interviewed Jeff years ago for SF Signal, he was talking about it even then. It was on the back burner. He was developing ideas. And what he told me at the time sounded really intriguing. So I'm curious to read the book and see how different it is from his initial conception that he told me about. That should be really cool. So I'm looking forward to that. I guess another obvious one is Kim Stanley Robinson has a new book coming out in March. Mm-hmm. That's about New York City. It's actually called New York 2140. This is someone else who obviously has a lot of focus on environmentalism and about how people shape the world. This is really something that Robinson really, I think almost all of his books you can argue are sort of about that. And I'm really curious after his last two books. He's almost been writing recently these sort of not anti-science fiction, but sort of very questioning. They're clearly science fiction books. They have a lot of the tropes of science fiction, but they're actually sort of asking a lot of questions at the same time. And they do things that are a little unusual or unexpected for science fiction. So I'm curious how this much more near future kind of book is going to work out and what he's going to do with it. Caitlin R. Kiernan has a new novel coming out also, I think in February.
Oh, the it is a Agents book of Dreamland. Because Agents I've got Dreamland, that on yeah. order as well.
Aha. Well, it sounds great. Because it sounds like she's taken a whole bunch of these sort of ridiculous ideas about conspiracy theories and sort of futurism, and then she's kind of mashed a whole bunch of stuff together. And from what I've heard of the book, it sounds like a very intriguing mix. And I look forward to seeing what she does with it, because I've read her two volumes of short fiction from Sub Press, and it'll be good to get back to her writing a novel, a more full-length thing. So that should be pretty good. And then John Darnielle has a book out also in 2017 called Universal Harvester that is set in a small town where a video store clerk finds out that for some reason all the movies he rents out people bring back because there's a mysterious section on each tape that just shows pictures of a local barn, some weird noises.
Okay.
So, I'm very curious what that's going to turn out to be. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. It should be very interesting. So there's that. Robert Jackson Bennett is going to have his third Cities book out, City of Miracles. That should be great. I look quite forward to that. And then there's another book coming out, sort of an odd book. Otessa Moshfe, who wrote a book this year called Eileen, is coming out with a new book in 2017 that sounds like a weird, sort of a weird book.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's anywhere near as, you know, brutal and strange and revealing as Eileen, it should be quite a good book. Homesick for Another World is what it's called. So I'm also very much looking forward to that. I think that is my list of books.
Mm-hmm. Very neat. Fred, how about you?
Well, TV, Expanse Series 2, movies, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and Valerian. And then in books, yeah. I don't think I have too much overlap with John DiNardo or John Stevens, but I might have some overlap with you. So Neil Asher has a new book in his Transformation series coming out, Infinity Engine. Greg Benford's got an alternative time book coming out called The Berlin Project, in which instead of bombing Japan, we bomb Nazi Germany. So that'll be hopefully fun. Maybe it'll be like his Timescape or something. John Joseph Adams has an anthology coming out with a lot of familiar names, and I want to buy it just for the cover, which looks like a Chris Foss. If it isn't Chris Foss, they found somebody who does Chris Foss as good as Chris Foss does. You know, two Chris Foss-like spacecraft on the cover. That's Cosmic Powers, the Saga Anthology. The Saga Anthology of Faraway Galaxies. I mean, come on, space opera, how can you go wrong, right? On the more horrible end of things, Charles Stross has got a new laundry novel coming out, The Delirium Brief. I love those stories. You know, bureaucracy and sanity losing Cthulhu mythos monsters, a perfect combination that always works. And Lovecraft seems to continue to have something of a reboot, so we've got The Winter Tide coming. Ruth Ann Emrys, it's I think about Innsmouth, so that'll be fun. former podcast guest and hopefully future podcast guest, Stina Like, continues her Gunpowder series with Blackthorn. That's coming this year. Looking forward to that. Of course, I don't know if I'm going to find time to read any of these books, but they're all pre-ordered, so, you know, whatever. Nidhi Okorafor, Binti, Home, is coming out this year. What else have I got? You already mentioned New York 2140, so forget that. Greg Eakin's got a new book coming out. Dichronauts. You know, obviously knots. You can figure out N-A-U-T-S that it's some sort of traveler. Dichro? I'm not sure. But his stuff is always interesting.
Yeah.
And then in the Star Wars universe, Chuck Wendig winds up his trilogy with Empire's End. And then Timothy Zahn, who started probably the second and bigger wave of Star Wars novels way back when with his trilogy of books, comes out with Thrawn. So good old Thrawn is back in the expanded universe. So that'll be fun to read as well. So, you know, this does not account, of course, emails that I get from Subterranean Press saying, hey, look what limited edition we're waving in front of you. Or John Stevens saying, hey, Fred, guess what I found? These are the e-books or paper books I know I've already pre-ordered. So there we go.
Wow. Yes, I did have the Asher and the Egan.
You know who else? I don't know what the title is, but Linda Nagata has got something coming out this year.
Yes.
So.
Yes, she does. Yes.
Sorry.
It's all right. I'm looking forward to a lot of those. I would be remiss if I did not mention that one of the first genre releases of the year was a anthology called Reliquary, which was put together by the group The Hourlings, which is my old writing group up in Virginia. I do have a story in it, and there's a lot of other fairly talented people looking at it. Seeing the final version of stories that we all workshop together is rather interesting. It's out in paperback now. It will be out in ebook form very soon. Let me just double check, make sure it's not out. Yeah, no, just paperback right now, but it will be out in on Kindle presently, if not sooner. I mentioned the Yoon Ha Lee. You mentioned Neil Asher. Joe Walton's got two books coming out, one Poor Relations, and Joe Walton, I will read Sight Unseen. So any new fiction by her is always anticipated. And the other book, which I'm certain will cause no splash whatsoever in the world of fandom, is her Informal History of the Yugos, which will be coming out later in the year, and which I also look forward to very much. There's a new Ada Palmer book from her Terra Ignata series that will be happening. And I'm trying to focus primarily on... and of course, a new Foreigner book by C.J. Sherry, because that's a given. So, and a lot of the collections that you mentioned that are coming up as well, I'm really looking forward to. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming out. And I do recommend reading Mr. DiNardo's two-part epic list of speculative books to look for 2017, which was a great fun to read because I do love it when he gets excited about things. So,
and we will include a link.
Yeah, oh, yes, we will. It was kind of funny how many more books regarding Lovecraft's universe are coming out, making this yet another continuation of 2016, which I look forward to.
Also new for 2017, we would be very remiss not to mention Mr. Patrick Hester. His book, Into the Fire, Samantha Cain, number one, is out. available from on the Bane website and fine bookstores everywhere. So please read it and then email him and tell him that we told you to read it. So that we can get our cut.
Yes. Oh, and the other one I had on my list was K.W. Jeter is returning to the Infernal Devices universe with a new mystery set in that. And I'm looking forward to that. I really enjoyed those books. So those are a couple of the many, many things. So as we've done nothing but talk about our favorite books that we read and that we're looking forward to, the one thing I do want to bring up regarding culture consumed, which Mr. Stevens has talked about a few times on this series in the past and his culture consumed, is that since I have taken my new job down here in Atlanta for a major broadcaster, I have pretty much been exposed to much, if not all, of the TV show Arrow. And I had not seen this at all, and to pretty much binge sometimes multiple seasons in parallel, my head really, really hurts now. I'm greatly confused by this show because I don't think it knows what it wants to be. It doesn't seem to have a overarching theme. It just seems to be one layer of corruption piled on top of another, and then these flashbacks that sort of give us this glimpse into the fact that the world is more than everyone thinks it is. The main thing for me is that, having read The Adventures of Oliver Queen through most of my life, this guy doesn't really seem to be Oliver Queen all that much. And that's not always necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the movie version of Hellboy was certainly a different personality than the comic book version. And we've seen that with a lot of you know, comic characters that have made their way into movies and TV shows. But this just seems to be a completely and utterly different character altogether, who lacks any of the gruffness that Oliver Queen was known for. And that's really kind of off-putting. I mean, some of the central tenets of the character seem to be gone. And so it's been kind of tough to get through, given as I've never seen any of the you know, DC TV stuff that has come on in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a very difficult show to get through and to stay with. And I'm kind of surprised it's lasted as long as it has, and the fact that it's made as big of a splash as it has. I guess the whole ensemble, you know, ensemble drama involving superheroes and supervillains and all that just manages to get by on enough of its own momentum without necessarily needing to deliver anything worth enjoying.
I mean, a soap opera at this point.
Huh?
It's a big soap opera at this point. That's part of its charm.
Yeah.
Oh, because when you look at what fans are talking about, they're talking about who's hooking up with whom, you know, who's going to find out about whom's, you know, secret whatever.
Yeah.
And that's been part of the evolution of it. Has been transforming from a remarkably gritty superhero story to a fairly pedestrian superhero story to essentially a soap opera.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're in a world where everybody gets to be a superhero.
Yeah.
Like, literally, everybody gets to be a superhero. And, you know, so it's all about who's going to be a superhero next and who's sleeping with whom. And that's the disappointment for me, because the first season, I thought, did a fairly good job of basically trying to deal with one of the, you know, sort of one of the problems that certainly Alan Moore identified way back when with superheroes, which is, you know, if you're a vigilante, you're probably going to do horrible things to get the job done, because that's going to be what's required. And so I don't know if people, I'm sure regular watchers know this, but I mean, the first season, he's a cold-blooded killer, a very, very anti-hero-ish kind of character, but then a totally confabulated cliche thing in the final episode of season one has him turn his back on killing. And then, I mean, we go from there. And like you said, I mean, this is not Oliver Queen that we comic readers know. Mm-hmm. It's in no way Oliver Queen. And, you know, that was probably a good move on their part, for, you know, a television show. They wanted to have more, you know, wider consumption. You know, they had to have a hot hunk playing Arrow, and he had to be someone who was privileged but not super arrogant or super, you know. It's like I think this was just a sort of a choice on their part for how to present a character that they thought would be more accepted by a TV audience.
Right.
But at the same time, in the first season, they took this risk of making him a killer, because he is just cold. And I actually really admired that about the show, was that this guy is really cold. He is just, you know, he's not sugarcoating anything, and he will absolutely do what he has to do to take the bad guy down. And, you know, like I said, for me, that was great. And I think for some viewers it was too. But I think a lot of viewers wanted to be invested in the character. And I think that's why they sort of made a certain kind of change in what how the character worked.
Right.
Because if you can't have a six-season TV show where the main character slaughters everybody.
Sure. You know, it's so weird because when Green Arrow was introduced in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon, the key scene was basically Batman saying, "We could use your help," and Green Arrow saying, I'm here to protect the little guy. I don't fight, you know, world threatening bad guys like you do." And Batman says something to the effect of, "You know, when the world threatening bad guys show up, it's the little guys who get hurt the most." And it was the whole idea of Green Arrow, yes, being gruff and fairly anti-establishment, but also realizing that, you know, there's a greater tide of good being done by the characters in the DC universe when they work together, was neat. It was a neat way to, in a very short amount of time, really develop his character very quickly. And I always liked the way he was portrayed in that. I mean, quite frankly, I think if you hold any of the DC movies or shows up to what was done in that franchise, starting with, you know, Batman the Animated Series all the way up to Justice League Unlimited, I mean, they did a great job of being very faithful to those characters, and doing so with very, very tight scripts. And so it's kind of difficult to, in thinking of that, it's kind of tough to sit through an episode of Arrow and go, "Oh God, where are we going now?"
Right.
Yeah. It's been difficult, but that's pretty much, you know, I've been watching that at work, and lots of Law and Order. And last night I watched, for some reason, because I was thinking about something else that's coming in 2017, which is the adaptation of American Gods, I went and watched Day of the Dead, the Babylon 5 episode that Neil Gaiman wrote. And as soon as I finished that, I went back and watched the original pilot as well, which I had not seen in quite a while, probably about 8 or 9 years.
But which version?
And which version of the pilot? The one that was on the DVD. The first season DVD.
There's the recut version with the new music, which, you know, the music that was used throughout the series.
Yeah, no, this had the Andy Summers soundtrack.
Yeah, I'd like to get that. I'd like to get that soundtrack.
This was yeah, that soundtrack was very good. I had forgotten how much of a procedural that movie was, though. That was very much, you know, the alien relations almost running in the background.
Well, the guy that ran Murder, She Wrote, you know.
Yep, I hear that. But that was good, but I really haven't done too much of that. I haven't picked anything up since I finished Revenger. And I got a few magazines of shorts I want to get through, and haven't really watched anything either. I can't get back into movie or television drama right yet. My brain's still not there yet. So, Freddie, what have you been playing with? Diving into.
I'm reading the Alistair Reynolds. Speaking of Alistair Reynolds anthology, The Best of. Aquila Rift, which was from Subterranean, I think is now also out from Gollancz as well. So a couple of stories into that.
I want to read the new Merlin story is out.
I have that as well, The Iron Technician. This anthology is, I mean, it's pretty complete as far as all the long stuff that was released as chapbooks under PS and things like that. So it's got Sleepover and Thousandth Night and all sorts of stuff that you can only get separately. So it's a very, very, very good collection. And I think the ebook is being sold online for some hilariously, ridiculously low price. So, you know, look for that. In the middle of many, many books without really feeling like I'm making any progress, like Jerusalem. That's just such a long book. So heavy, so heavy. It will crush me in my sleep sometime. And I actually wanted to mention something very weird that I've noticed, which is not culture consumed, but attempting to get me to consume culture. I set up alerts for various authors, including Samuel R. Delaney, because I'm looking for news about, for example, the journals coming out and stuff like that. And I've noticed that I always get at least six of the alerts are for not shadily acquired ebook versions of his various works, and they're all from various Russian servers. So I didn't realize that Samuel R. Delaney was so popular with the Russian malware crowd. I mean, whatever. You know, that is actually a book that I'm looking forward to. I believe we're going to get it in 2017.
That's what they're saying.
He's on Facebook, you know, occasionally showing off the copy that he's got. So, you know, I am hoping to get my copy sooner rather than later. So,
He is super pleased that it's coming out.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, the one day, I mean, this weekend, you know, we had a college visit yesterday, college visit today. Last weekend, I spent essentially 3 days on Amazon's alleged help system trying to get my Kindle Paperwhite to work again. And I essentially have come to the conclusion that I know more about Kindle technology than the Kindle help desk does. I spoke with people in India. I spoke with people somewhere not India. I chatted online with all sorts of people, and everybody gave me solutions that I said either that I already tried or I knew would not work, and in fact, their solutions did not work. So I lost 3 days of... I had a free weekend, which I was going to dedicate to reading, because it was a holiday weekend, 3 day free weekend, and I couldn't read any of the books that I planned to. I had paper to read, but I had this whole lineup of ebooks ready to roll and couldn't get at any of them. So that was my lack of culture consumed.
Johnny, what about you?
Let's see. I am also going to try to read more this year. I I set a goal for 2016 of 60 books, and I ended up only doing like 35.
No, I don't feel that bad then.
I don't know, and I don't really know. I can't really explain why. But it just, and you know, and like 10 of them were graphic novels, which, you know, can take a million years to read. So it's really hard to say why that's how it happened. But anyway, I finished Le Guin's Found the Lost, which I think I may have mentioned last time too, which is her collected novellas, and which I heartily recommend to everybody. It's big, but it's very hearty. It's another one of those situations where it's nice to have all these things in one place so you can read them all together. You come away with a very different take on some of them than you might have earlier. In terms of other stuff, like I said, I've watched trying to watch new movies this year. Would be I watched Train to Busan, which is a Korean zombie movie that I found to be remarkably good for a zombie movie. A lot of people had recommended it, and I was trepidatious because zombie movie. But I had a go at it, and the things that I think made it work were that they didn't try to explain much about what was going on. And the characters had no special knowledge of what was going on. They were just in the middle of it. And they had to deal with this unbelievable thing, you know, and make snap decisions based on what was happening or what they didn't know was happening. That gave it some nice. That gave it nice tension, a nice amount of tension, because it was a little less about people getting by the zombies than the live people trying to figure out how to deal with it, and both emotionally as well as sort of circumstantially. So that was cool. And then I liked the characters a lot. They really tried to. You know, the characters weren't especially rich, but they acted for the most part like people. They didn't act like future zombie slayers. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't like people in The Walking Dead who can just pick up a crowbar and start stabbing zombies through the skull. And part of that was they used the sort of the fast zombie trope. In this one, so they're not slow, they're pretty quick, and they turn immediately, and it doesn't take long for there to be a lot of them with that formula in place. So that was something that sort of cleared the way for dealing more with people's reactions, because it becomes clear pretty early in the film that it's very difficult to fight these zombies. So people have to figure out different ways to deal with them. But, you know, people were trying to make up ways to deal with them as they went along. And no one was a particular badass. And, you know, they were on a train, so their range of weapons was pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing people deal with it the way that it was set up in the movie, I found was more powerful than a lot of other zombie movies are with the effect, the reactions of regular people still alive. So it was pretty good. I actually cried a little in the end because it was a sad ending. But I was surprised that it was as affecting as it was. And so I certainly highly recommend seeing Train to Busan. And then I also saw an action movie from a couple years ago.
Oops.
Called The Deadlands. That's New Zealand movie set in sort of pre-colonial Maori times and dealing with a young Maori man who has to avenge his tribe after they are after they are messed up by a rival tribe. And I've had kind of a mixed opinion of this because the storyline is pretty predictable. And it's got most of the, like, you know, the hero's journey elements to it. And I felt that I knew how things were going to basically turn out pretty early on. But what made it more interesting and distinctive was the one, is one of the characters called the Warrior, who is this outcast who lives in the Deadlands, and whom the boy enlists to help him get vengeance on. He's played by Lawrence McAlare, who you may remember played orcs, all kinds of orcs in Lord of the Rings.
All the orcs.
he played like all the orcs. He's a really good actor. I don't think you get to see much of that in Lord of the Rings, but he's quite a good actor. And he just did a fantastic job with the Warrior in this movie. And that's the real, for me, that ended up being the real core of the movie, was seeing him go through different emotions and different, and you know, figure out who he's loyal to and what he should be doing and should not be doing and things like that. That ended up being really the heart of the movie for me. And the movie had a few problems, but overall, based mostly on his performance, I was entertained. And that's sort of the most genre-y stuff I think I saw this time around.
Mm.
So, I'm almost done with The Leveler Revolution, which I mentioned previously, which is a very good book, a very good historical breakdown of the Leveler movement in Britain, and is well worth reading for the historical detail as well as the general thesis that the author John Rhys is trying to put forward. That's about it for me for now.
Cool. Very good. Well, the new year brings with it new stuff to consume, and I'm certain we will all be consumed by it. So,
great.
Yes. Yes, falling under a giant pile of books at some point. So, anyway, hell, most of mine are still boxed up around here, so I think I've only got two shelves, and the new stuff that I've bought has been mostly used stuff, and I got one shelf of just that, so... Someday it will all be free again. Well, anyways, we look forward to all of this in 2017, and we are going to have some interesting guests as well as the year progresses, and maybe a few returning ones and a few subjects that we want to cover. So we hope everybody who's listening has been along for the trip here with the Incomparable. And, got any final thoughts, anyone?
Nope.
It's all been said. The rest is silence. All right. Well, we will be back in February with a new episode. We hope everybody has an excellent 2017. And until we meet again, I bid you all adieu and good night.
Good night.
Yep, good night.